You've been planning to do things for your family or maybe see a young child for the first time in many, many months, and that then is taken away from you.
Indonesians hit by floods and landslides. It's Wednesday, April 7th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online. You'll find us at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, neighbors team up for travel. North Korea not playing games. Hunger threatens millions. President Biden works on climate and a budget. A charitable hobby. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Search and rescue efforts are underway for at least 72 people missing on several remote islands across eastern Indonesia in the wake of a tropical cyclone that struck the region last week. The torrential rains produced by Tropical Cyclone Saroja triggered flash floods and landslides that washed out bridges, downed trees, and left roads thick with mud, which has complicated efforts by rescue crews to reach remote villages. At least 128 people have been killed, with thousands more displaced after their homes were damaged or destroyed. One of the worst incidents happened on Lembata Island, where scores of homes were destroyed when the rains dislodged hardened lava sitting along the slopes of a volcano. Tropical Cyclone Saroja also left a similar trail of destruction in neighboring East Timor, killing 27 people on the outskirts of the capital, Dili. Seasonal flash floods and landslides kill dozens annually in Indonesia. Two landslides in West Java province back in January killed 40 people. Also dealing with water, hundreds of thousands of seafarers who are stranded across the world because of the coronavirus pandemic. Advocates for the seafarers say it is a humanitarian crisis that threatens supply chains. We hear more from Henry Ridgewell in London.
Ritesh Mehra signed up for a four-month contract as captain of a liquid gas tanker in July last year. More than 8 months later, he and his crew are still stuck on the ship, unable to leave because of the coronavirus pandemic.
So the thought of not being able to go back home in time and the thought of being chained to this particular place and in a way you can also say jailed is getting onto crew now. They are thinking more about it than the actual job at hand.
There are an estimated 1.6 million seafarers worldwide. In normal times, they work 4 to 6 month contracts before crews are rotated. But global travel restrictions made those rotations increasingly difficult, according to Guy Platten of the International Chamber of Shipping.
By the autumn, we had well over 400,000 who were far beyond their original contract tour lengths, and some of them have been on board for well over a year, up to 18 months.
Platten estimates that some 100,000 seafarers are still stranded.
But what we're really feared of now is that just as we were starting to make progress with a new variant, it's starting to get worse again. And of course, with the idea of some sort of vaccine passport being introduced by countries as they come out of COVID, it's just going to go back to square one again.
In the waters off Hong Kong, dozens of ships lie at anchor, their crews unable to come ashore because of the pandemic. Reverend Stephen Miller of the local Seafarers Mission runs a supply launch that delivers goods such as mobile phone SIM cards and snacks to the crew members on board. He fears for their mental health.
You can just imagine it for yourself. You've been planning to go home, you've been planning to do things for your family or maybe see a young child for the first time in many, many months, and that then is taken away from you. So that obviously leads to sadness, which can lead to depression.
Several shipping firms, trade bodies, and maritime labour organisations have signed the Neptune Declaration on seafarer well-being and crew change. It calls for all nations to recognise seafarers as key workers, allow them to travel, and offer them priority vaccines. Chief Officer Karen Marshall spoke to VOA on her way back home to Texas after being stuck at sea for several months.
Merchant mariners should definitely be priorities when it comes to getting a vaccine, and the fact that we're not is insane to me. I think companies should work on making their employees, getting the vaccine for their employees so that we can start getting back to a normal crew change, normal rotations. We can all go back to our families.
The signatories to the Neptune Declaration say seafarers will play a vital role in maintaining supply chains required to roll out global vaccination programs, and all countries must recognize them as key workers. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar's online pop-up markets raise funds for protest. Brunei calls for ASEAN meeting to discuss Myanmar situation. At least 25 dead after ferry sinks in Bangladesh. Taiwan reports new incursion by Chinese jets into defense zone. China adopts Kremlin's information war tactics. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found online at Facebook at VOA Asia. And we invite you to check out our website. That's voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has said a quarantine-free travel bubble with trans-Tasman neighbor Australia will begin April 18th. It will allow unrestricted movement between the two countries that have managed to contain the virus through strict lockdowns and international border closures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealanders have been allowed into most parts of Australia since October, but travel the other way was banned. New Zealanders who did make the journey across the Tasman Sea also faced a mandatory two-week stay in hotel quarantine on their return. Those arrangements will soon change. New Zealand authorities say that just before midnight local time on April 18, a so-called travel bubble, allowing unrestricted movement, will start between the two countries. Authorities believe the risk of transmission of COVID-19 from Australia to New Zealand is low. At a press conference in Wellington, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the travel plan was the only one of its type anywhere.
I can confirm that quarantine-free travel between New Zealand and Australia will commence in just under 2 weeks' time. This is an important step forward in our COVID response and represents an arrangement I do not believe we have seen in any other part of the world, that is, safely opening up international travel to another country while continuing to pursue a strategy of elimination and a commitment to keeping the virus out.
However, travel between Australia and New Zealand could be disrupted should future outbreaks of COVID-19 infections be detected. Officials have said that flights would be suspended from any Australian state or territory if authorities there ordered a local lockdown. To be eligible to travel to or from New Zealand on a quarantine-free flight, passengers must not have returned a positive coronavirus test result in the previous 14 days. They must also not be waiting for the results of a test taken during that period. New Zealand has recorded 26 deaths related to COVID-19 since the pandemic began, while about 2,500 infections have been detected, health authorities say. Australia has recorded just over 29,000 coronavirus cases and 909 fatalities. Both countries have closed their international borders to most foreign nationals. They have allowed citizens and permanent residents to return home, but they face 14 days in mandatory hotel quarantine at their own expense when they arrive. Australia and New Zealand have both embarked on mass coronavirus vaccination programs. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. India's health ministry said Monday it had recorded an all-time high of over 103,000 new coronavirus cases, the highest daily tally this year in the South Asian nation. Mumbai is at the epicenter and is under stringent lockdown measures. You'll find all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We hope the day is nice where you are, and thanks for joining us today on VOA Asia. North Korea says it will not participate in the upcoming Tokyo Olympics due to concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. It is the first country to pull out of the Olympics, which have been delayed for a year. VOA's Bill Gallo has more from Seoul.
North Korea has imposed some of the world's toughest coronavirus prevention measures. Perhaps then, it should come as no surprise that North Korea announced it will not send a delegation to the Summer Olympics in nearby Tokyo. The country's sports ministry says the move is meant to protect players from the pandemic. North Korea has nearly completely sealed its borders for well over a year. It insists that has kept the virus out of the country, a claim largely dismissed by experts. The North's Olympics decision suggests the draconian lockdown may continue. Park Won-gon is a professor of North Korea studies at Seoul's Ewha University. He says the move reflects North Korea's extreme fear about COVID-19. But he also stresses the decision may not be final, leaving some room for the Games to serve as an opportunity for sports diplomacy. South Korea had proposed using the Games as a way to revive stalled inter-Korean cooperation. That would mirror what happened in 2018, when the two Koreas sent a joint team to the Winter Olympics. The two Koreas later held negotiations that led to meetings between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump. For now, though, that doesn't seem likely. North Korea has boycotted any talks for over a year. Instead, it has mostly focused on domestic challenges. North Korea is the first country to pull out of the Summer Games, which are set to begin July 23rd, with strict virus prevention measures in place. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
Happening now in Asia, protesters marched around the streets of Mandalay, the country's second largest city, despite escalating violence by security forces in breaking up street demonstrations against the February 1st coup that ousted the elected government. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, a report by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization and World Food Program warns many of the more than 174 million people suffering from acute hunger across the world are likely to die without urgent international assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Those most affected by acute hunger are people living in 20 so-called hotspots. Topping the list of areas where people face catastrophic levels of acute hunger are Yemen, South Sudan, and northern Nigeria. The director of the FAO office in Geneva, Dominique Bourgeon, says multiple drivers are behind the soaring rates of acute hunger. He says those factors are interlinked and mutually reinforcing in most of the hotspots.
These multiple drivers are, first, conflict or other forms of armed violence. As a result of the economic impact of COVID-19 pandemic, we also wish to flag that the economies of numerous countries in 2021 will continue to be highly vulnerable to economic shocks.
While the majority of affected countries are in Africa, the report warns acute hunger is due to rise steeply in most regions of the world. Among those most at risk are Afghanistan in Asia, Syria and Lebanon in the Middle East, and Haiti in the Caribbean. The report finds more than 34 million people already are facing emergency levels of food insecurity, with many on the brink of famine. It notes families in pockets of South Sudan and Yemen already are in danger of starvation and death. Director of the World Food Program's office in Geneva, Annalisa Conte, says people facing famine-like conditions have depleted their assets, lost their livelihoods, do not have enough to eat, and most of their children already are acutely malnourished.
Excess death due to hunger is taking place as we speak. You need to understand that beyond this point, there is starvation and widespread mortality. The window to avert a catastrophic situation, I would say of a biblical proportion, is closing fast.
The UN food agencies are calling on international donors to provide $5 billion in emergency food assistance to prevent 34 million people at risk of famine from starving to death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Making headlines in Asia, Chinese tech giants are expanding in Singapore as they face a crackdown at home and growing pressure in other key markets. Messaging and gaming behemoth Tencent is opening a hub, while TikTok owner ByteDance and e-commerce giant Alibaba are on a hiring spree. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, President Joe Biden signed a series of sweeping executive orders aimed to cut oil, gas, and coal emissions to tackle climate change. Biden said he wants the United States to once again lead the global response to the climate crisis, a sharp departure from his predecessor. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
2020 was the hottest year on record, following the planet's long-term warming trend, according to NASA data. Aiming to cut oil, gas, and coal emissions to stave off the effects of climate change, President Joe Biden said the U.S. can no longer wait to deal with the climate crisis, calling it an existential threat.
And just like we need a unified national response to COVID-19, we desperately need a unified national response to the climate crisis, because there is a climate crisis. We must lead global response.
On Wednesday, Biden signed executive actions on climate, including stopping new federal oil and gas leases, ending subsidies for fossil fuels, taking steps to conserve 30% of the country's land and water by 2030, and moving toward all-electric government vehicles. These actions followed Biden's move on his first day in office to rejoin the Paris Accord, the global climate agreement President Donald Trump withdrew from in 2017.
Paris alone is not enough. Not when almost 90% of all of the planet's emissions, global emissions, come from outside of U.S. borders. We could go to zero tomorrow, and the problem isn't solved.
Kerry said the Biden administration will commission a national intelligence estimate on the security implications of climate change. And for the first time, climate change will be a core consideration in U.S. national security and foreign policies.
The test is going to be on how he overcomes the constraints, how he kind of drives this agenda, and even pushes back entrenched interests while working with those that are committed both domestically in the United States and internationally for a post-carbon world.
Biden said his climate action plan will help bring economic recovery by creating jobs for workers in the declining fossil fuel industry, an idea criticized as ludicrous by the president of the West Virginia Coal Association.
Why we would want to trade one job for another and go through the transition and all the costs, particularly when the end result is going to cost everybody more money.
The administration's climate plan also prioritizes environmental justice by directing agencies to invest in low-income and minority communities that usually bear the brunt of natural disasters, pollution, and other impacts of climate change. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News.
President Biden recently announced a $2 trillion spending plan aimed at modernizing the nation's roads and bridges, among other infrastructure. The plan, however, is expected to face obstacles in Congress, as we hear from VOA's Michelle Quinn.
It's time to build our economy from the bottom up.
President Biden's proposed infrastructure plan paints a broad picture of what counts as infrastructure. It's not just for fixing roads and bridges, but for building out broadband internet and technology to mitigate climate change.
In my view, this is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. I don't think in the next 50 years we're going to see another time when we have this combination of a demonstrated need, bipartisan interest, widespread impatience, and a very supportive president who is committed, by the way, not just to the infrastructure itself, but to the jobs we're going to create.
The package's jobs plan includes building the nation's clean energy workforce and boosting caregiving as a profession. Republican leaders say the proposal is too big. The package envisions a network of 500,000 electric car charging stations by 2030.
When people think about infrastructure, they're thinking about roads, bridges, ports, and airports. That's a very small part of what they're calling an infrastructure package.
Paying for the bill is also an issue. The package proposes tax increases on corporations, which Republicans say they oppose. The bill is now being taken up by Congress, with Democratic leaders aiming to get it to the president's desk for a signature in the coming months. The package will be a test of the Democratic Party's unity. If Biden can't get support from any Republicans, he will need every Democrat to vote for it in the evenly divided Senate. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
For many parents, one good thing about grown kids moving out is the opportunity to focus on personal hobbies. VOA's Maria Iman Santoso tells of one woman whose hobby benefits others. Dania Iman narrates the story.
These colorful beanie hats in the shape of popular cartoon characters are the work of Vera Fuad, an Indonesian-American living in California.
The hats themselves take very little time, only half an hour to knit. The longest thing to make are the eyes and the mouth. For a minion, for instance, those huge eyes take 1.5 hours for each hat. The most time is spent on the smaller details.
They're not just fun eyes, they are also functional. Some of the hats go to underprivileged children in Romania. Stephanie Vogel is vice president of Firm Foundation, a charitable organization in Brasov, Romania, that helps young children through education. She says the beanies not only provide warmth, they also show them that someone cares.
If it's minions, butterflies, flowers, or a bear hat, the kids love them. Winters in Romania can be crucial and cold, but it's so awesome for these kids to walk around with a minion hat.
The beanies also end up in Ukraine. Kiev teacher John Musgrove says his students get a whole new experience when they receive one of Fuad's handmade hats.
They'd never seen such a hat before. It brought smiles to their faces a mile wide. And the parents were also extremely happy. They were happy just to realize someone remembered them, someone cares, and took the time to handmake gifts. Very practical gifts.
Fuad began knitting as a child in the city of Bandung, Indonesia. But after moving to America, she didn't knit again until after her children were grown. At first, she donated her beanies to the cancer ward of the Children's Hospital at the University of California, Davis.
Nah, mulainya itu,
I started again maybe 7 years ago. One of our family friends, also from Indonesia, had cancer and was hospitalized at Stanford Hospital at that time. So every time I visited, I saw other children with cancer. I felt sad for them. They had no hair.
Fuad then donated hats to child refugees in Sacramento.
That's the least that I can do to make them happy.
It's unimaginable what children with illnesses go through. I also donate to underprivileged kids. Just simple cute hats, but it makes them very happy.
My day.
Fuad formed a knitting club with other members of the Indonesian American community.
We decided to together make as many beanies as possible to send to Ukraine.
I wish there's more people yang help out.
While still sending beanies to Eastern Europe, the Sacramento-based knitter also donates hats to homeless individuals in a city with a significant homeless population. For Nia Iman Santoso in Washington, Dania Iman, VOA News.
Our time has drawn to a close for today's program, but we invite you to join us again tomorrow at this same time. Thanks for joining us for VOA Asia, and we thank our VOA Asia team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day today. Be safe. Be well.